Mavericks.
The Movie Mavericks Podcast.
Movie Mavericks, speaking of fucking long, uncut European cocks.
The Movie Mavericks Podcast.
Now for your hosts, Jason and Trevor.
I can't wait.
Hey now, everybody. Welcome to a special episode of the Movie Mavericks Podcast, where we are clearly getting too old for this shit. Throw you over to Jason Rugard. He'll tell you what's going on.
Yeah, aren't we? I mean, that's like the – is that not the ultimate line from this series too? I feel like you should have like a little like saxophone kit, you know, and a little guitar string behind that. We're talking about Lethal Weapon 2, in my opinion, the best in the Lethal Weapon series. We'll get into that a little bit in our ranking on Trevor. we're like the Bickersons over here. I feel like we're Riggs and Murtaugh on this episode because
– it'll be fine.
Apparently, you didn't have the same reaction to going back and viewing this as I did. Initial reaction on this for you?
Siskel to your Ebert, you know?
Yeah,
I just thought this was a bit too messy and a bit too neat all at the same time. And I really didn't like what they did with the Riggs character. And Murtaugh is just a bumbling idiot.
I will get into the plot and your reasons for that. But let's talk about some of the peripheral things first. Lethal Weapon 2 premiered in July 7th of 1989, and it was the highest grossing of the series. $147 million back in 89 translates to a whopping $330 million today. That's basically what superhero movies are doing now. Mm-hmm. Its opening of $20 million, it translates to about $46 million. It barely beat the third weekend of Batman. So these are two Warner Brothers films basically cannibalizing each other, unfortunately. And I think that speaks to the surprise even Warner Brothers maybe unexpectedly didn't think Batman was going to be such the phenomenon it was, you know. And I think they could have used a little bit more spacing and could have dominated the summer a little bit more.
Batman then was as insane as Dark Knight was, right?
Yeah, I mean, just like a phenom that they didn't expect to have any sort of the resident. I mean, they knew it was going to be big, but not that big, as you can see by their scheduling of this. I think they kind of backed themselves up.
You really think so? I don't know. I think they knew that Lethal Weapon was going to be big.
But Lethal Weapon 2, I mean, it reigned at number one for 3 weeks at the top spot of the box office, number one draw in the country, but it was in the top 10 for 13 weeks. It's over 3 months. It's unbelievable. It had a great run, obviously. And I think
it made a lot less per week than movies do now, though.
Right. I mean, yeah, if you open up with 46 and make 330, you can see the whole multiplier there. 89, the summer of 89 was a summer of sequels. From my count, there were six sequels released that summer. And I want to give you my list of the top of my ranking of those, and then you can give me yours. All right. The best of the sequels of the summer of 89, Indiana Jones 3. And then I would say Lethal Weapon 2. And then I would say License to Kill, the Bond film, even though it's not technically a sequel, it's part of a series. And then I would say Ghostbusters 2. And then I would go Star Trek 5, Karate Kid 3. Ugh. I know we're getting really at the bottom of the barrel.
Christmas Vacation? Forgot that one.
But that's Christmas. I mean, that's not. I'm talking about the summer period.
No, Christmas Vacation. Oh, you're right. You're just talking about summer?
Yes. Yeah.
Well, I guess. I mean, that's an obvious order, so I would just go along with that.
Thank you. I mean, these last two spots, though, are very flip-floppy. How do you rank the Lethal Weapon series overall? What's your ranking on the four?
I rank the first one as good, and the next three as okay, and I don't rank them because what's the point? I mean, 3 and 4 are practically really useless. They exist, and so they're Lethal Weapon movies, but other than that, I really have no endearment towards those whatsoever.
I think you're downplaying the fourth one a little bit. I think the fourth one's better than the third. The third one is extremely bland.
Big deal.
at least the fourth one has an element of – I think it's funnier and it's got better action than the third one.
Sure. Well, by the time the fourth one was made, it's much slicker, right? This series, especially after watching this, I feel like it just went downhill after the first one.
I think the first two are of a piece, and the three and four are obviously determined by, you know, their existence is determined by the huge grosses that, you know, each film made. I mean, I think
Lethal Weapon 2 is only alive, and this version of Lethal Weapon 2 only exists because of the studio and wanting to make a sequel. I mean, I would lump this in with those other two.
Which, you know, obviously this was a great call by them. Look how much money this made. Look how commercially successful this was in all aspects. I think this is a fantastic sequel.
Better than you think that you would like the original Shane Black version of this movie.
Yeah, I don't want to see the characters die.
Really? I would love to see the Shane Black version. That's the version that I wanted to see, not this. This is some glammed up Hollywood sequel thing. It's way too jokey. Riggs is terrible in this. The one-liners are horrific. And in the middle of action stuff, he's trying to act crazy but be funny at the same time. It's like, what the fuck are you doing? And then it's not good. It's not funny.
You will be the Siskel on this show.
I will be. And I'll tell you, it's interesting because we went through this on Passengers, and I gotta say, what you didn't like about Passengers, I think, is exactly what this movie is.
How so?
What I just said, it's all glossed over. I mean, you didn't like the ending of Passengers, but you like the ending of this movie. But you don't like the dirty dark ending that Shane Black originally wrote. But you wanted that for Passengers.
I thought Passengers was. I can't believe we're talking about or comparing these two movies. But Passengers
was
boring. And this thing moves like a bullet. I have no. There's
no, this
no
does
dead
not
spot
move like
movie.
A bullet. That's no. That's.
Where's the slowdown in this part?
Where's the slowdown? What's the plot of this movie? How come the people say the plot is this Getz guy and all this stuff when he doesn't show up till halfway through the movie and is barely in it?
Oh, it's not. It's him stopping the money launderers.
It takes so long to get to the plot of this movie because they're so busy playing up these two characters who aren't funny, and quite honestly, is kind of boring. It's like they just have these boring lies, but Riggs is still crazy, right? He's got to be a little crazy, and Murtaugh's still the stuffy old cop, and it's like, well, we're just check for the first half of this movie, we're really just checking in with these guys as they kind of wander around and do nothing.
Well, that's what a sequel does. You got to pick up the characters, and I think that this one has a clear intention of being more of a comedy, and I think that is absolutely simplified
by terrible.
The opening, when it has the Looney Tunes theme at the Warner Brother logo before we go into the middle of a car chase, first of all, that shows that this is going to be basically a visual cartoon. And second, picking up in the middle of a car chase, as Donner says in a making of snippet that I didn't include on this show, but it is available on YouTube, he analyzes the car chase sequence and he says they continually tried to figure out ways to open this movie and it was all exposition. And he said, make them the Bickersons. They've been married too long, and set them in the middle of a movie that's already going on. And I love that about the first 10, 20 minutes of this movie. I really do. And
I think just to clarify this argument, I think this goes back. We had this argument about the first one, really between the director's cut and the theatrical studio cut of this. And it was the same argument. I think it was the same argument. I don't want this to be just some stupid little funny action movie thing, which is, you know, my words, not necessarily what it is. I see so much more that it could be, and that's what I want. And I feel like I'm missing that, you know?
Today we have, you know, the superhero movies dominating the multiplexes. Back in the 1980s, the loose cannon cop movies were, you know, the superhero movies of their day.
They were so good.
I mean, probably nobody
started more. As much as I
complain
about this movie, I would much rather go see this movie released today. The cop movies are great.
And ironically, Batman, like I said, premiered during the same summer. And that kind of foreshadowed where, obviously, the film industry was going, and that this was maybe the last hurrah and definitely the financial high point of this subgenre, the buddy cop movie. That really started with 48 Hours earlier in the decade.
Well, if you want to go down this lane, let's talk a little bit about how great it is to watch just a car chase without CG stuff, just cars running, like created through editing, and also stunts that are real stunts, you know, not against a green screen on wires and stuff, but actually a guy being thrown off of a truck or being dragged underneath it or hanging off the front of it, or, you know, all that fun shit.
It looks dangerous. It looks like it was dangerous to make sometimes, and it looks
fun.
Other
it
times
looks
it's
so
obvious.
Simple. It makes it much. Well, it just looks real.
Well, you called it a little too neat. I don't know if you mean the filmmaking style, because Donner's filmmaking style is very efficient.
I'm
very
more talking
clean.
Story. Yeah, I love Richard Donner as a director.
Yeah,
I would never do that. The action in this movie is fucking phenomenal, which is the only thing that saves it for me, and the reason that I would like it. I don't like the writing at all, but direction's great.
Let's talk about how it cemented Gibson as a legitimate box office draw that would basically continue on a 10-year climb that possibly, I don't know where it culminates. Does it culminate with him winning Best Director with Braveheart? Does it culminate with the 1-2 punch of What Women Want and The Patriot in 2000 where he couldn't do any wrong? Is it The Passion of the Christ? Where does it culminate?
I'd say Braveheart was the end of the run. You know, that was like the top of the mountain, and it was a pretty quick backslide from there.
But let me name off a couple of titles that were big hits after that. You have You have Ransom. You have his collaboration with Donner again in Conspiracy Theory. You have Payback. I mean, these were all movies that did exceptionally well at the box office.
And those were all movies that was a style. While those were still good, that was the style that was slowly dying out and being replaced with things like The Matrix, right?
You know when I knew he was a huge star was after this movie came out and Bird on a Wire did phenomenal, and that movie's such shit. You're like, oh, he can carry anything. He can make Air America into even a modest grocer.
Yeah, well, he was lucky enough to be in that time where it was a time of supermodels, right? It was a time when celebrity meant more than just being in Us Weekly and shit, you know? And people following you on Twitter, right? It meant people actually putting down cold hard cash based on sight unseen on some fucking thing you were in.
This movie to me is so glossy for its time that it's almost like they perfected the formula before they couldn't do anything more with it. This was like the coup de grace. This was, you know, your big ending. This was the finale and the fire show. And let's take a break real quick and listen to the trailer and just listen to the slickness and the efficiency with what they get across, what they're selling to you here.
Who is it?
Police, open up.
How do I know you're the police?
After I shoot you through the door, you can examine the bullet. Open up.
Mel Gibson, Danny Glover.
Come on, let's go, Roz.
Let's go.
Come on, Roz. Don't be a killjoy.
Come on, we're back.
We're bad. You're black. I'm mad.
Good man.
Hey, listen. If we're going, shouldn't I have a gun?
No.
Now, get ready for something lethal.
I'm surprised you haven't heard about me. You know, I got a bad reputation, and sometimes I just go nuts like now.
Because the magic
gun
is back.
Roz, out the window, Roz.
You all right, man?
Yeah, I'm okay. Where were you, man? You're my partner. What? Why didn't you follow me down?
Yeah, why didn't you follow him down?
Shut up! I'm 7 floors up!
Lethal Weapon 2.
You go first. I'm really too old for this.
You go first. I'll cover you.
Eeny, meeny, miny.
Hey, Mom!
Good police work, officer.
Come on.
No.
Back to my place. Hey, I'll even cook.
You're lucky. I have to live with that.
You're not gonna make it.
I'm gonna make it.
You know, there's not enough room.
You were right, you know. Yeah, there wasn't enough room.
Lethal Weapon 2. This time, they're not taking any crap.
Just get off me, man. I don't want anybody to see us like that.
All right, I love that preview. I love that we have the original, the theater voice guy there was Don LaFontaine.
Right.
You know, I love that voice there, and all the clips. As I was watching Lethal Weapon 2, I still, for some reason, had that trailer moments in my mind where something would happen. I go, oh yeah, that was in the trailer. That comment was in the trailer. And I still listened to the theater when I was a kid, and I remember the theater just being in an uproar every time Leo Getz did anything and the action they clapped at. Did you see this on home video? How did you come to this movie?
I'm fairly certain I saw this on home video.
Yeah, I was young to be seeing this in the theater.
I doubt I did. You lived in the city still, right? Or close enough. Yeah, we had. Well, I still live outside the city. It's hard to get to the movie theater.
It's 2017.
So
sir.
I didn't see a lot. I know. I got my movie pass. I'm going. I'm gonna go.
You better, because I'm gonna start going. You get him and not go. Something that I proposed to you at the top of the hour, and we were doing a little bit of research. We couldn't figure out if this is correct or not. But to my knowledge, this movie was released as a sell-through title, and what I mean by that is on its street date. For those of you that were born after 1990, you might not understand this, but you couldn't always just buy the movies you wanted to buy whenever they came out. You had to wait 6 months before you got like a previously viewed copy or taped it off a TV, and that means like VHS tape, actual tape, with commercials and everything, or HBO. And I think that this was the first movie that on its street date was available, a rated R movie, I should clarify, for 1995, and not in a previously viewed format where you got a couple copies 3 months later from a Tower Records or wherever your video store was. And we can't, you know, to your best knowledge, that's correct. Is that right? You agree with me on this?
I'm going to say that there's a strong possibility because I can't think of anything else and I can't find anything. So
very few titles back in that time were considered sell-through titles. The next big rated R sell-through title that I can recall was T2. But that would be in late 1991, which was another big sell-through title. But before that, they saved them for things like Top Gun and very special releases. Even that might have not been a sell-through at the time. But do you recall the video of this having the Warner Brothers catalog commercial with Daffy Duck and the – do you recall that at all? Am I going crazy here?
I do.
Yeah. Isn't that weird? That was on the front of Batman, too.
Yeah.
You can't watch a Warner Brother movie without a Warner Brother ball cap. Does this all recall any like Bugs and Daffy? It's out there on YouTube. Check it out. Some of the stranger bit of marketing for this is that we're going to break real quick once again. I want you to hear this because it blows me away that they found a way to connect Lethal Weapon 2 with the Los Angeles Lakers, who were in their heyday of the 1980s at the time, into a crossover commercial with Magic Johnson to sell the sell-through VHS title. Listen to this.
The magic is back.
What magic?
Mel Gibson, Danny Glover, Lethal Weapon 2.
Now we're cooking.
On video cassette.
And man, the magic is lethal.
Lethal Weapon 2, for sale at stores everywhere.
Is that not some shit? Can you believe that? What's the point of that?
Yeah, I don't understand. I don't know.
I mean, what is
Why is it magic? Is that somehow, that's not in the movie anywhere. Like, they don't talk about magic, do they?
It would almost be like today if Ronda Rousey or somebody was like hucking the Wonder Woman DVD. You know, like, what the fuck are you doing? What are you doing here? Was that I thought about the tagline of the movie, actually, thinking back on it. The magic is back on the poster, I recall that.
Yeah, is that where they got that from?
Yeah, how clever. Some marketing genius said, hey, we can get Magic Johnson to do it. He plays in the Lakers. This movie's set with the LAPD, back when the LAPD were still considered heroes. But I think this movie moves like a bullet. Where's the slowdown in this, you told me?
Well, the whole beginning of the movie is a slowdown, but I think, just case in point, how long does it take to get to the actual plot?
But look how much good stuff is in there. Okay, let me name some things during that first hour that apparently...
Okay, the pen conversation.
That's a great scene.
It is. It's also slow. And it goes nowhere and has no value. You asked me where the slowdown was. Well, there you go. There's one.
I don't think that's a slow scene. I would say maybe it's a slow scene until the end when they have that look to each other because Roger comes in and he says, oh, Trish found the pen. And then they have that moment where they look at each other where it connects those two characters. I like that. That's her moment in the movie, and she's gone after that.
That's being too neat. I mean, the very fact that he meets the killer of his wife is just...
We need to talk about this.
Fucking ridiculous.
We need to talk about this.
That practically ruins the movie for me.
How they could... For what reason the guy... They say it's an informant, blah, 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 and they try to, like, very loosely tie that all in, but I don't understand what she would be doing in that, what he would be doing in that. It's such a strange concoction to throw in this script. I hated that part, actually. I was going to ask you specifically about that. Do you understand how that works, like, from a story point? How she was supposed to be involved? I never picked it up.
Yeah, you know what? My head was swimming when the fact that he even started that conversation. I was like, oh my god, I totally forgot about this shit. Which is weird because I remember the ending fight. But it's like, good lord, why? Why can't the guy just be a bad guy that he fights at the end? Why would you do this? It's so neat and like stupid, and then it makes Riggs even crazier. And then they go and they kill the other girl, which makes Riggs even crazier. And he basically turns into like just a psycho idiot, just blathering, you know, they killed her, she's dead. He sounds like Rain Man for a while. It's like, good lord.
My other serious question to you is this. Why does Riggs wear a Letterman jacket throughout this film?
That's what is a good it question. With the 1980s? I never thought about that.
he has the Axel Foley syndrome from Beverly Hills Cop 2.
Yeah, yeah, that's a good catch. I never even thought about that.
The whole time I'm sitting going, what's with the Letterman jacket?
I guess because it's like...
He gives the girl his Letterman jacket.
I know. It's like the style of... I don't know. It is a style, though, isn't it?
I think you're being kind of
trying too hard. Yeah, I feel like it is a style for him, anyways, to wear a Letterman jacket, just to, I don't know, make him kind of kiddish, childish,
jocular,
you know,
in some way,
yeah, jocular, you know, that kind of stuff. Because he's very incredibly immature throughout the movie. That's like, he's no longer, you know, I guess suicidal, but he still has to act crazy, which is just basically immaturity, right?
Yeah,
I think we can agree to that. Yeah. So maybe that's what it is.
I could buy that. But during that first hour that you say is no good here, I want to list off a couple of my favorite things.
Well, I'll be honest with you. I think the first hour is actually better than the second hour, but I don't think that it lends to a better movie because it doesn't really go anywhere. I enjoy checking in on these characters and things, but what's the point
for scenes like this when the first time that we re-meet his family, Roger's family. Mm-hmm. I mean, the rubber condom commercial. I mean, I love that sequence.
Yeah, that's great. And it also doesn't pay off.
It does later when Leo's in the hotel room and he says, "Hey, I love this kid. She got a great body." That's a nice snippet too.
It barely. That's not a payoff. That's like
during that first hour we have the drive through rant.
That's like an extra thing.
Which became infamous after this movie. That became, you know, part of pop culture for momentary. We have the toilet bomb. Great sequence. We have the car chase, both of them, the one to start the film and the one through the hills. And tell me this wasn't the first time, and maybe the last time, you ever saw a guy get decapitated with a surfboard. How cool was that when you were a kid?
It was very, like, ahead of its time as far as, like, killing people in interesting ways, you know.
So was the plastic on the floor. I always thought that was cool. And also, this is the movie that taught me what a cougaran was. I happen to know what that currency was as a child because of this. So it was like weird things I learned through action film. But I do love that commercial sequence with the daughter and the way that the cops are fucking with him back at the station. And obviously the big elephant in the room that we really haven't even talked about yet is the Leo Getz character. Before we get into that, though, let's take a break and listen to Siskel and Ebert heatedly discuss their views on this.
Our first movie is Lethal Weapon 2, and in a summer of sequels, which have often been pale imitations of the originals, this one is an exception to the rule. The original Lethal Weapon was one of the smartest and most exciting cop buddy action pictures of recent years, and Part 2 is as smart, as exciting, and just as well written. This is not a lazy retread, but a sincere effort to do justice to the original film, and it really worked for me. With a lot of sequels, the filmmakers use all of their ideas in the first movie and then they just rip themselves off the second time around, but not this time. Lethal Weapon 2 was directed by Richard Donner, a talented action director who also made the earlier film as well as the original and best Superman movie. His writer this time is Jeffrey Boehm, and together they've kept the feel and charm of the original film, including the odd couple relationship between the middle-class Glover and the street-crazy Gibson. And then they've added some effective villains, and especially the brilliant comic relief of that fast-talking little government informer played by Joe Pesci. The movie is entertaining from one end to the other.
Not for me. I had sort of a split reaction to the picture. I liked all the things happening outside of the main characters. I think Joe Pesci is absolutely wonderful. You know, if comic roles are ever going to get Oscar nominations for supporting, at least, this, I think, would qualify. He's terrific. And I liked this woman, Patsy Kensit, who you didn't mention, who was the girlfriend, the love interest of Mel Gibson. I thought she was really erotic and kind of exciting, fresh face. She's a rock singer. But the two main guys bored me because they were doing a lot of this false laughter and false... I thought that the guys would be, in reality, much sharper than they were. I thought in the first film... Gibson's character was really suicidal, and that was part of his excitement because it wasn't just a wild man. He was a wild man for a purpose. Here now, he's just sort of playing and being a wild man.
If you remember, Gene, by the end of the first film, he had come back from that.
I know what he's supposed to do.
He's still crazy now, but at least he's not depressed.
He wanted to kill himself. Now he wants to live. I understand that.
Well, what's wrong with that? That's a good idea.
There's nothing wrong with it. It's just the way it's
played. But there's still interesting guys who know each other and who like each other and who stick together and who save each other's lives in this movie.
Let me ask you
especially
something.
In that scene where the booby trap bomb is going to go off. It's very well played.
Let me ask you one thing. Do you know what I'm referring to when I say about the false conviviality of scenes like that?
I didn't feel it was false. I've seen a lot of movies this summer in which nobody on the screen was as intelligent as everyone in the audience.
Yeah, right.
In this movie, it seemed to me the intelligence level was higher, and they were not. They had a lot of interesting new situations, a lot of interesting setups, and special effects here. They were not simply
doing
a pale retread.
Okay, it's not as bad as the Ghostbusters sequel or the Star
Nowhere
Trek sequel.
Nowhere near as bad,
But I thought that the people around them were original. They themselves were not special.
Okay, even without being able to convert you, I'll just say this. If people want an action picture, instead of Ghostbusters or Star Trek...
Go see Batman.
...or Batman, go see this one.
No,
it's a lot more fun.
Leo, does he make the film or hurt the film? Is it more of a comedy, obviously, because of his inclusion? And would it be better if he wasn't in the script?
I don't think he's in it enough. Ask anyone to describe this movie to you. They're going to describe him as a major focus of the plot, and it's not true, you know, and it's something that they tried to remedy, and certainly for a reason he's in 3 and 4. Joe Pesci's great. He's absolutely hysterical. I love that character. And if you want to have comedy in the movie, you know, rip it out of Riggs and Murtaugh and put it into him and put him in the movie, and then you can have dark and light all at the same time.
I agree with Siskel, with Siskel in that he should have been nominated for an Oscar for this, because if comedic performances were ever to be nominated, his energetic,
I just think it wasn't enough. I really wish I would agree with that if he was in it more. It needed to be a more substantial role, you know, it just deserved to be.
Well, by Donner's own admission, he says that Pesci was the missing element, or perhaps like the last puzzle piece between the trio, making it a Three Stooges type vibe, which is foreshadowed by Riggs watching the rerun of the Three Stooges earlier in the film, which sets up the inclusion of Leo two scenes later. So there is that vibe in it. There is that kind of he's the dog in a sense, or the child between these two married couple. That's paid off beautifully in the end, which I think is a great touch by Donner. I don't know whose idea it was, if it was in the script, if it was Pesci's idea, if it was Donner's idea, whose idea it was, but the last moment when Leo's saying goodbye to Riggs and Murtaugh and he hugs him, I fucking love that moment. I think Pesci plays that moment great. Mm-hmm. I think it's a great bit of relief after a big action sequence where Riggs pulls the house down on the stilts, which is the climax of the movie, because the movie's actual action climax is kind of a letdown. The shipyard shootout with the car that looks odd coming out of the container and into the water. I don't know why that looks so odd, that special effect. Not a big fan of that, but I do love the house coming down on stilts, and I love when Leo hugs the guys goodbye.
Yeah, I mean, Getz is a very funny character, and I don't know. It is one of those characters that just happens to, tell you everything you need to know. He's one of those kind of guys.
Yeah, he's happens to be keyed into everything.
Try to push him like, yeah, what do you know? Nothing? Oh, damn, what do we do now? Oh, wait a minute, there was one thing.
Exactly.
I do remember this other thing. Oh, yeah, okay.
I remember this one guy one time at a party. He brought a monkey and he did this.
It is fun, you know, the idea that he kind of remembers where the house is and stuff. Then they got to take him with them to find that. Like, they do a good job of keeping him in the fray, you know, of keeping him in there when normally, and I guess in the Shane Black script, it was, you know, it was a one scene, one off thing.
I think that he's in this just enough because he's in part three so much and it's so forced that everything that Siskel says about this movie, I feel about part three in his review of it. And I feel that Pesci especially feels congenial, fake, you know, like, he's trying too hard in part three. In this one, I thought he hit just the right note. He wasn't overdoing it. There wasn't too much attention on him. And he was the little brother in a lot of sense. I also found it interesting that the marketing of this movie, that there was a GMC truck tie-in, which is the truck that Riggs pulls down the house with. And all the, you know, the station wagon, it's all GMC cars throughout it. So I found that kind of interesting, at least that the good guy's driving. The bad guy's driving BMWs in the beginning there. But how invaluable is this Michael Kamen score? I mean, does it not just make this movie feel a lot weightier than it even is? I know you say it's light as it is, but does it not?
I don't know. I didn't notice the score when I was watching it.
You didn't hear the horn cues and the delicateness? No.
It really just had no effect on me.
Oh, this guy's a
stone wall. I couldn't even tell you what the score sounds like.
I heard
like,
no music.
So, yeah, I didn't. I think it was nothing. To be honest with you, I think the story just threw me for a loop for just what they were doing to this. I don't know. I don't like it. I'm with Siskel and I'm with Shane Black.
Wow, he did.
I don't like what they did.
Siskel and Black.
I'm trying to name drop to get people on my side here.
What do you think about Patty Kinsey in her small role? I mean, she's given nothing to work with here. And basically, I think she's a knockout in this. And her only other credible role that I can recall was in an HBO made-for-TV movie called Full Eclipse.
So here's – I mean, Siskel said the same thing. I mean, carefully, what you both said was that she looks really good.
Yeah.
That's true because she's a terrible damn actress, and she's really terrible in this movie.
But there's a great fuck scene. Let's be honest.
Yeah, see what I mean? So that's all fine and well and all, but that's what I think of her. That's why she's not anything else. She couldn't carry anything else, right? She's basically the Bond girl, if that.
She would have been a good Bond girl. Now you bring that up even. I mean, that could have been a good – see, I just dropped the hammer. I just dropped the mic and I said it. I'm out.
You're done. That was it.
Exactly. Cubby Broccoli, you can pay me over here. I want to bring to attention a couple of my observations on this movie. One, I love that in movies, I call it the video store syndrome, when they go to a video store and the whole wall has like only movies from the right. company that's releasing the movie. And in this yeah. movie, if you remember,
those Danny are my Glover, favorite.
He goes to pop in a movie from his own collection to look at his boat, and all his sell-through movies are all Warner Brother titles. Uh-huh. And not only that, they're the big clamshell ones from the 80s. You know, they didn't slim down.
It does
down
make sense because you don't have to ask for permission, you know, and for to put those movies in there. And it's free advertising, right?
Yeah, right. I just always love that when you go to a video store and it's yeah. like, oh, this is a Columbia movie, and these are all Sony titles on this new release wall.
There's like one movie. They have like a million copies, which you would never see in like a mom and pop movies rental place, which they always go into, but there'd be like, you know, one whole bay of just like the same movie. It's like, nah.
I also want to point out that the actress Jeanette Goldstein, not Jeanine Goldstein, Jeanette Goldstein, who was a Private Vasquez in Aliens and was John Connor's mom or stepmom in Terminator 2. And she's also the female cop who dies on the diving board here. Was my high school English teacher's sister, Mr. Goldstein's sister, Jeanette Goldstein. Big ups to her because every movie she's in, she's like a villain or getting fucked up. So I always, she was like appearing in all these movies from my childhood.
So what are you, 4 steps from Kevin Bacon on that one?
I thought I was more like 3.5 steps from Vasquez. On that one. I just want to run up to her and be like, has anyone ever mistaken you for a man? She probably slapped me and be like, no, it's you. Observation here is that my favorite bit of filmmaking in this is when Donner goes back to his horror roots, a la The Omen, in that nail gun sequence when the guy comes through the plastic. I love that you don't see that guy's face. He's a faceless attacker. He uses the shadow well, and he's got that low angle shot when Glover shoots him. And then that last that line, nailed him. I mean, jeez, man. I mean, that doesn't get in the 80s anymore than that, right? I mean, just
– yeah.
I feel like we should be flying jet planes and, you know, it's just drinking Coca-Cola.
They basically were.
Yeah, all day they were drinking their own Coke, that's for sure. You know, I'm glad I went back and watched this one. It sounds like this might have hampered the overall legacy in your mind of this series. As you get older, do you think you grow a little because you've seen more?
Yes, definitely change, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, I would agree with that. I feel... not as bad as after I watched Die Hard 2, but you know, it's kind of that, a little bit of that, like, what, like, oh, because obviously as a kid, you know, I watched this very differently than I do now.
Yeah, I this was a sell-through title. My neighbors had this on VHS. My parents bought this on Laserdisc. It wasn't even a widescreen Laserdisc. It was the full, and it was a flipper. Well, I guess they were all flippers, but it was a pan and scan, so it was just dog shit ratio. And I saw this movie so many times that hearing some of the dialogue was almost like hearing a song you hadn't heard in a long time. And the cadences of certain things, you know, it was a nice recall to that. And it, for me, this ranks as one of the best sequels ever made. And you might call me crazy on that, but for me, I think this is the gold standard of what a buddy cop 80s action film should be.
I just don't think it was that good just to call it a gold standard.
Maybe I'm bringing too much nostalgia to it, but that could also be the case.
Yeah. Well, it is what it is. I mean, it's certainly a product of its time, which I think you said. And when you watch it, you definitely get the feeling of what era this came from, you know, which is great. You know, and I think for me, I miss buddy cop movies. Even like I'm complaining about this, but I just miss them like this, you know, because nowadays buddy cop movies are all doom and gloom. You know, they're very it's so much more about the murder and like the mystery, which is great. I love private detective stuff. Detective things are fantastic, but we're still kind of missing, you know, the buddy cop movie, which we got a little bit with the 21 Jump Street stuff, but.
That was way more comedy. I feel like
I understand it is, but it was closest that I can come up with, you know, at this point to that. Yeah, vastly more comedy, yeah. And I would like to do a little bit more action, I think. We miss that now. I mean, most of the other stuff that's coming out that's like buddy cop movie stuff is really like Shane Black stuff, right? And that stuff's awfully dark.
It's very nihilistic.
Very good, but awfully
even
dark.
Esoteric
not
in the sense
the same.
That not many people are in vibe with what he's got going on now. And the things like this that are similar are being relegated to television, even the namesake television Lethal Weapon that's on right now, which I think is a superior show to a lot of procedurals that are on television. But I don't think that these kind of movies can get the funding they once did. And even when you do see them, they have some sort of supernatural angle or X, Y, and Z. You know, they're a it's not feasible any longer. Their day is coming.
That's what
gone.
I'm saying. There's always about. I mean, this is such a simple plot, right? I mean, and nowadays it would be about more like a Seven type thing, right? It has to be about like the murderer and like the mystery of it all, and you know, it's Jigsaw or it's something else, you know, and so not even like the Buddy Cops don't even get a chance because they're not even the stars of the movie.
These movies were very dismissed too by. Not by critics, but from the critical community, in the sense that not many awards were bestowed on this for, because they don't award action or stunts or any that kind of stuff. So there's not many outside of the sound,
that's
possibly.
Yeah.
So I feel like these are forgotten, and these take a lot of time and planning. And Donner, to his credit, he pulls this off magnificently. I mean, he is the man when it comes to making these kind of slick movies. My only complaint is that as his career got further along, he would infuse more of his own, I don't want to say agenda because it makes it sound like I have some sort of problem with it, but I do get irritated here about like don't eat the tuna, and then there's another one, it's like the no fur and the anti-abortion. It's like, come on, man, it's clear what you're doing at this point. Just stop it. This isn't like a product placement thing. This is you speaking to the audience through
I totally get what you're saying, but as far as the don't eat the tuna thing in this, I felt that really worked because it's such a product of the time.
Well,
like,
it
really
pays off.
It really made me feel like it was 1989 again, because that shit was rampant.
Mm-hmm. But it also pays off when Pesci gets the tuna sandwich. So I will say that. Whereas in later Donner films, it just is like on T-shirts and things. It just oddly, you know, just around it, and it pulls me out of the movie. And politically, whether I agree with it or not, it has here or there. It pulls me out of the fucking movie every time I see it. And it happens in Assassins. It happens in this. It happens in Part 3. It happens in obviously Part 4. It's all over the place in his movies. But Donner's such a good director. The only time I feel like he's ever been out of his element was in Assassins. But that's a whole nother conversation. I just think he was the wrong director for that material. But he was absolutely the right director to helm the Lethal Weapon series. I mean, he really established, with him and George Miller, obviously, established Mel Gibson. And Danny Glover, too. Danny Glover, let's not forget, the next year goes on to make Predator 2. Mm-hmm. And you could see he actually was a viable kind of action star. I didn't have any problem with him in Predator 2. He's not
I like
Predator 2.
Yeah. Well, I like the movie in general, but
it's not the first one, but he's not. You know, people will always say, it sucks. And I'm like, well, he's not the problem in it. If that's your problem, and he's not bad.
No, he's very good in it. Yeah, it's not the first one. That's for damn sure. It is a completely different movie. Sure.
Yeah,
but I still liked it, and I do like him in it. He's good in everything. I mean, he went on to, obviously both him and Gibson went on to do some you know, award winning dramatic roles.
Great work. I mean, Gibson and Glover are both fantastic actors, and you put them in this, and it seems like they could do this both in their sleep.
I suppose Glover was doing stuff before this too, but yeah.
Also, just want to throw out one last thing before we go here. I want you all, if you have time, to go onto YouTube and check out the HBO behind the scenes, the HBO first look, I think they used to call them, if they still do call them that, back when they were relevant. Some of the best ones I ever saw as a kid were the ones regarding the Lethal Weapon series. Part 2 and 3 were done by Gibson himself, maybe the first things he directed professionally, and they're mockumentaries where he's running around the Warner Brothers lot talking to other actors, Chevy Chase, Michael Keaton, anyone that had a movie going on the lot, and messing with them, and they all get injured, or he messes them up. They're absolutely fun to watch. They were all shot on a VHS camera and hastily edited, but they're super quirky and actually fun. So check them out. They're the HBO behind the scenes series. Did you ever watch those when you were a kid? Those used to be like,
yeah,
I would wait
great.
For those every month. Yeah. Do you still watch them?
No, I don't. I don't watch any behind the scenes stuff because it's all really not like it used to be.
I feel like it's not really a glimpse anymore. It's all just a prepackaged gloss. Maybe it was always that way, but I felt like I get like a glimpse before of something, some movie magic being made.
Yeah.
I
mean, now
the Terminator 2 one was big, too.
It's totally just an advertisement now.
Yeah, I tried to watch the Mummy one, and that was basically like, oh, this is that – this is when you rent the Redbox DVD, and they have like the one special feature. Oh, it's this. It's the 8-minute
– Yeah.
getting a blowfest here of how great it was to work with everybody, how everyone's a fucking genius, and the movie just, you know, was the best experience for anybody involved. And then it comes out and it bombs and everybody distances themselves. Yeah,
that's usually it, right? It's talking heads over maybe some behind the scenes footage, and that's it. It's just, boy, we really like this.
Yeah, but in its heyday, when they had the behind scenes for Alien 3 or Batman or these Lethal Weapon, I mean, these were
they took time back then. It felt like, you know, things were just better. I mean, watch special features on DVDs for something new, and then go back to something in the late 90s, and it'll probably really blow your mind. You know, the difference. You could learn a lot. Through the special features. I mean, the commentaries today are still good. Those are still equally as good, but you really have to listen to commentaries instead of go to the special features now.
If you go back to the Robin Hood DVD and Blu-ray, it has this making of 1 hour. It's not even a making of, it's the history of Robin Hood that was on TV the night before. It was hosted by Pierce Brosnan, for God's sakes, before Brosnan was Bond even. I mean, just a television actor. I mean, so people really did this. If you go back and look at the special, the HBO first look for Speed, I believe it's hosted by Dennis Hopper. I mean, they had real people doing this stuff. Like, the actor signed on to do this because they knew this was their viral video campaign. Check them out if you get a chance. That's going to wrap up our Lethal Weapon 2 retrospective. Going back and looking at it, Trevor had a negative opinion of it. I still think it holds up and is one of the better sequels of all time. Let us know what you guys think either on the Facebook page or at moviemavericks.com on the page of this podcast. Thank you all for continued listening to the show. We'll be back with you next week with a regular episode. Until then, I'm Jason Rugard, speaking for Trevor Anderson, and we are the Movie Mavericks.